The question that we are considering today is, what is spirituality? If we pose the question to ourselves, each one of us, and jot down our ideas, thoughts about this subject, we will find that each one has our own unique understanding of what is spirituality. But one thing is certain: when we analyze the trend in the society, there is a distinct surge among people of all classes, of all nations, a surge of interest towards spirituality. It is expressed through various means. Now, the reason for this is to be inquired into before we proceed with understanding what is spirituality. The first cause for such a surge is to be found in the natural tendency of man, of every one of us, to search, aspire, and reach for the infinite. It is a search, a perennial search within each one of us for the transcendental. As Krishna says, in the hearts of all I preside. So, our essential nature, being spiritual, divine, infinite, no matter how much we try to console ourselves and comfort ourselves with material things, none of it will be satisfactory. And there we will be left with some kind of discontent and some kind of despondency, irrespective of what our external conditions are. We may be rich, poor, or any such conditions. But this natural search for the transcendental, aspiration for towards the infinite, this thirst is not quenched by our educational system. Our education fails to provide meaning to our life. It fails to provide a ennobling and an aspiring purpose for our existence. It teaches us a few facts about the world that we live in, but completely ignores, and what is more troublesome, it completely denies anything of the world which exists within us. In the text the Isis unveiled, the teacher surveys the human heart in general and makes a very poignant remark about the condition of human soul. She says there is a constant guerrilla warfare between the two titanic forces, science and religion. Between these two conflicting titans, she says, is a bewildered public, which is us, all of us, a bewildered public, fast losing all belief in man's personal immortality, in a deity of any kind, and rapidly descending to the level of a mere animal existence. This is the tragedy of science This is the travesty of religion, and this is a failure of our education system, which leaves an empty void within us. In the Key to Theosophy, the teacher says, what is the purpose of true education? What is it supposed to achieve? She says a few things which will appeal to every sincere student of theosophy and someone who loves humanity. She says education, true education, the aim of it is to, I quote, to cultivate and develop the mind in the right direction, to teach the disinherited and hapless people to carry with fortitude the burden of life allotted them by karma, to strengthen their will, to inculcate in them the love of one's neighbor and the feeling of mutual interdependence and brotherhood, and thus to train and form the character for practical life. And our education system does the very opposite of this. She says, what is the purpose of an object of modern education? She says, it is to pass examination, pass examinations. A system not to develop right emulation, but to generate and breed jealousy, envy, hatred almost in young people for one another, and thus train them for a life of ferocious selfishness and struggle for honors and emoluments instead of kindly feeling. This is what our education system achieves. And therefore, we find ourselves and our society in such a pathetic and dismal condition, morally, spiritually bankrupt. The second reason we find is the second reason for this renewed interest in spiritual matters is because it is the characteristic of the very age in which we live. A human evolution proceeds by cycles, and at particular junctions of the cycle, when it is in its upward turn, just like when we wake up, when the time comes for us to wake up in the morning, so also the voice of conscience, the voice of intuition in us wakes up, and after a long period of sleep, it will begin to flutter back to life and speak. In one of her articles, she gives a very insightful picture of the current age. She says, the ship of materialism was sailing in full speed, and what was the destination of the ship? It took all its passengers towards the maelstrom of annihilation, she says. This current age, with its false animalistic, materialistic ideals, can only lead us towards the maelstrom of annihilation. So that was the ship in which the humanity was sailing in the 19th century. And then she says, initially, there was a puff of wind in the rigging of the proud ship. Only a puff of wind resisting this ship of materialism. But the puff of wind became a breeze, and finally, it grew into a gale. What is this gale which put a stop, or rather resisted, the ship of materialism. She says, and I quote, "It was the inner voice of the masses, their spiritual intuition, that traditional enemy of cold intellectual reasoning, the legitimate progenitor of materialism." So she says that inner voice, spiritual intuition, had awakened from its cataleptic sleep. That's why we find across the world there is a renewed interest from the latter half of the 19th century, that is the 1870s onwards, till date. She says these world ideals can never completely die out. Rejected and exiled by the fathers, it will be embraced with opened arms, welcomed with opened arms by the sons. So the very spiritual truths which were rejected by humanity in the past, the subsequent civilizations welcome them, accept them, and they become part of one's daily life. So this is the other reason why we find such a surge in spiritual interest, because it is time for the spiritual intuition within us to wake up and speak. But whenever there is the real, there is always the counterfeit. Whenever there is a real gold coin, you find that there are many fakes. There is real news and there is fake news. Similarly, you find in every aspect of your life, if you examine, whenever there is something good, the opposite of that also is there. So Krishna says in the Gita, light and darkness are world's eternal ways. So, though the real teachers, the rishis, the sages come and give out the teachings and the philosophy necessary to quench the thirst of the human soul, there will always be counterfeits, frauds, imposters, who also pose exactly like those teachers externally and then mislead people. Look at the commercialization of spirituality that has happened today. So many so-called gurus, they form their own empires, make commerce out of it, have their own products, whatever, organic, this, organic, that, t-shirts, everything commercialized, and with the influence that they have, get into political activities. I mean, all this goes on to show the, and with huge, huge, vast backing of their followers. So all these fake teachers appeal to human weaknesses and not to the human soul. So that is one thing that we have to keep in mind. A true teacher, when he comes, will never ask you to place your reliance and unquestioned obedience upon himself. A true teacher will never dispossess you of your agency, of your power to think, power to choose, power to act. The sovereign power of choice is always honored, respected, and encouraged by the true teacher, whereas the false guru will always ask you to rely blindly and become a follower. This is something that we have to keep in mind. There are many other misconceptions about spirituality that we need to consider, but There is hardly any time to consider all of it. But there is one thing that we can certainly touch upon. Of the many misconceptions, one of the ideas which has gained a lot of currency is the idea that spirituality is somehow deeply connected with becoming vegetarian. The idea that non-veg food, animal food, is something to be given up or something wrong, and one cannot be spiritual if one eats meat. Now, if vegetarian food alone were to confer moksha upon us, then all the bovine animals, sheep, cow, buffalo, they all would have reached moksha by now. Generations and generations of eating grass only, they would have reached moksha. And then there is that other problem. What about those men and women of various nations who are so good at heart, who are so philanthropic, who have sacrificed so much for the good of others, for others' welfare, worked for their welfare, but yet out of habit and out of heredity practices, they eat non-veg? What about them? Do you deny that they are any less spiritual than anybody else? The argument that is given is, when we eat animal food, we are committing violence. A very strange thing that when it comes to non-veg food alone, we remember himsa and ahimsa, whereas in every other aspect of life, we forget ahimsa. But life itself is full of violence, systemic violence, structural violence. In the very things that you buy, you are buying habits. There is economic violence. See the repercussions of the things that you buy, that you put your money in, whom you are encouraging. There is violence. The most important and the violence which has far-reaching effects is violence of thought, emotion, and feeling. Nobody talks of that. Violence is not about action of the body. The most terrible violence is committed in thought, because thought is more powerful than bodily acts. This is what Guru Nanak makes clear, or rather, illustrates in one of his travels when he reached Kurukshetra. And he says, I quote from his poems, he says, "You boast of your abstention from meat and count it an act of great merit and piety, but you never think of eradicating the evils which defile your mind and heart. You never do that. You think it is a sin to eat flesh, but you think it no sin to suck other people's blood, to snatch other people's rights, to commit adultery and a thousand other black and evil deeds." And then he addresses the priest class who take great pride in being vegetarians. He says, "You believe that those who take meat are sinners, yet you accept gifts from those very sinners and deceive yourselves by the thought that your avoidance of meat will save you from going to hell, where your benefactors are doomed to go. Isn't it a queer philosophy?" he says. So his advice is, he says, do not torture and disable your body. It is a vehicle of the soul. keep it strong and healthy, use it in the path of righteousness. Then you will come to enjoy true life of spirit. Remember, only such food should be avoided as may tend to produce pain and disorder in the body or evil thoughts and vicious longings in the mind. So this is a very golden mean that we can practice in our life and educate ourselves out of the idea that spirituality has got anything to do with mere bodily practices, whether eating this or avoiding something else. Now, in order to understand spirituality, moving on to the next section, one approach is to question what is meant by spirit. Spirituality comes from the word spirit. So understand what is spirit, and anything which is there in accord with spirit, anything that we do in accord with the nature of spirit, we may decide as spiritual in nature. Spirit is opposite of matter. So in one way, whatever is opposite of materialism is spirituality. But what is materialism? That we need not even analyze and question about, because we all know what is materialism, because we are all materialists. Materialism being a spectrum, we all are there very, very stably anchored ourselves in materialism, in the spectrum of materialism. We may appear very religious and pious by following the external, ordinances of our religion, whatever it is. It may be 5 times namaz or going to church or doing puja every day and various other injunctions of our particular religion. But inwardly, what are we? Our thought, feeling, emotions, those are the most important things. And in that, do we affirm the spirit as real, or do we affirm matter, materiality as real? That's the litmus test. This reminds the speaker of a beautiful kirtana by Tyagaraja. He says, Teriyaleru Rama Bhakti Margamunu. O Rama, we who call ourselves as your devotees, do not know the path of devotion. Rama, do you know what we do? We get up in the morning, do our daily, taking bath, doing puja, and, running the beads through our fingers, saying we are doing japa, where vibhuti or nama or whatever is our particular caste mark on the body. And, before that we take bath in the river and so on. Appear pious to the world, but O Rama, inwardly we are constantly anxious to make money. That's materialism. Our mind is constantly working, Tyagaraja says, constantly working towards devising various means, schemes to increase one's wealth, increase one's comfort. So he says, Theriyaleru Rama Bhakti Margamunu. We are not devotees, we appear as devotees. So what is materialism? We just need to look at ourselves and decide what is materialism. So one approach is that, understand what is spirit and decide what is spirituality for oneself. Another approach is take the example of one who is spiritual, noble, and emulate the person. That is another approach. In fact, if you look at the Gita, Krishna employs both these methods of teaching Arjuna, which is, one is speaking about what is spirit itself, like we read in the 13th chapter of the Gita. And in the 14th chapter, you find the characteristics, the way of life, and the marks of one who has rooted himself in spirit. So he uses both of these means, and I feel we should also do that. Understand what is spirit as well as emulate those who are truly spiritual. As to today's talk about spirituality, this student feels, first of all, nobody can claim to speak about spirituality and cover the whole topic. And that's not the purpose of this talk also. It's more to give a few pointers, a few suggestions, and share some understandings of the students, that's all. That said, this student feels spirituality, in one sense, can be understood by the triad, the triangle of A's, alphabet A. If you write three A's, A, 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 and remember that, it will give us some, what shall we say, suggestion on what could be spirituality. What are these three A's, the triad of A's? Acceptance, action, altruism. One by one we will go through them, and then in the next 10 or 15 minutes maximum, we will open the floor for any questions, discussion, and most importantly, sharing your ideas. Firstly, acceptance, the first A of the triad of A's. All our problems and anxieties in life come because we don't want to accept things as they are. Secondly, we don't want to accept responsibility for our life. Much of our pain and sorrow is not due to external circumstances, situations, events, people, their action or inaction, but because of the judgment that we make about what happens to us, because of our reaction towards it, because of our attitude towards it, underlying all of this is the assumption that I do not deserve this. The idea that we need to accept responsibility towards our life is an idea which is so opposite our current civilization that it grains against the very spirit of our civilization. We will be ready to accept anything except the fact that everything that happens in my life, I alone am solely responsible. But that is the truth. That is what all teachers say, and that is what any person who logically and for a long time contemplates on life from the right perspective, that's the only conclusion that he or she will reach. There is this beautiful story of Mullah Nasiruddin, of how he would accept anything that happens in his life by saying bahut khub, means very good, very well, excellent. So his son comes from the city to the native place. All the villagers and neighbors say, oh, you're so fortunate, your son has come from the city to help you in your native land. Mullah is unaffected by it. He says, bahut khub. Then the son has brought a horse with him The horse runs away into the forest. Then the neighbors say, "Oh, you are so unfortunate, such a misfortune, the only horse you had, such a good horse, which your son had brought, it ran away." Mulla says, "Bahut khoob." Then after a few days, the horse comes back with half a dozen more horses. It has made some friends, wild horses. It brings them. And then the neighbors think it to be very fortunate. They say, "Oh, you are so fortunate." Mulla says, "Bahut khoob." Then one day the son is riding one of the horses to break it. And he falls down and breaks his leg. Neighbors think it's a great misfortune. Mulla says, "Bahut khoob." Then the army of the king comes to village for conscription to take young men for an impending war with the neighboring state. And they find that this fellow is fractured and he is immobile. So he is saved from fighting the war. So again, the neighbor says, "All our children were forcefully taken away. Your child is still with you." And Mullah still says, "Bahut khoob." So the basic idea here is that Mullah had understood the basic fact of life, that everything that happens in our life is for a grand purpose, for a great purpose. And wise man is one who accepts life and works through it, takes a responsibility towards it, and does not jump to conclusions and does not get elated by the success, which successes many times bring us long-term disasters, dangers, or he doesn't get downcast by apparent disasters, which many times in the long term turns out to be our saviors. So Krishna says to Arjuna, "I will give you this most mysterious knowledge because you don't find fault with life." So that complaining attitude, finding fault with life and circumstance, is ignorance, because it does not understand the profound workings of the law of karma. In the notes on the Bhagavad Gita, the teacher says this: in order to reach the supreme condition, there is one thing which is absolutely important. What is it? Resignation to the law. It doesn't come just because we are hearing all this, but it certainly becomes a force in us, a conviction in us, when we take time to study the workings of the law of karma, the intricacies of the law of karma, the natural justice of life. So the teacher says we must cultivate complete resignation to the law, the expression and operation of which is seen in the circumstances of life and the ebb and flow of our inner being. All that can be gotten out of wealth, of beauty, of art, of pleasure, are mere pools of water found along our path as it wanders through the desert of life. All the benefits we have, fortunate things we have, what are all these oases in desert? Then he goes further, if we are not seeking them, their appearance gives us intense pleasure, and we are thus able to use them for our good and that of others, just so long as the law leaves them to us. But when the superior power removes them, we must say, it is just what I in fact desired. Any other course is blindness. All the passing shows of life whether fraught with disaster or full of fame and glory, are teachers. He who neglects them neglects opportunities which seldom the gods repeat. This is the constant strain, constant cry of even Marcus Aurelius, the great sage, the great philosopher king, who kept a diary where he jotted down his thoughts while he was in the midst of military conflict and guarding his frontiers. He would write down these thoughts, and this particular thought of resignation and acceptance of what happens to oneself in life comes out very strongly and repeatedly in his writings. I won't read it now, but if we have time later, we will consider some of his writings, profoundly moving writings, where he says that, Marcus, remember, you are a part of the whole. You are inseparable from the whole. And anything that happens to the part is for the good of the whole. Your events of life are not to be seen only in the context of your personal life alone. It has greater meaning, greater purpose. So accept them. And none of the circumstances of life can really touch you, can really affect you, can really harm you. Your soul is unharmed by anything that happens to you. But there is one way by which you can harm your soul, and that is by complaining, fretting, and fighting against what has happened to you and not taking responsibility. It's not the same words that he uses, but this is the spirit of his writings. So the first A is acceptance. So does it mean that the person becomes a passive onlooker of life without engaging with life? That's the mistake that we Indians have done by misunderstanding half-baked notions, having half-baked notions of the law of karma. Many youngsters and educated people rail against the idea of karma because they don't understand what is it, what it is. They have some vague and distorted notion of what is karma. So this takes us to the next idea, the next A of the triad, which is action. At one or the other level, we all expect things to happen to us. We all expect to reap benefit without working for it. We can find the tendency in one or the other sphere of our life. And it is this weakness of ours which is exploited by all the spiritual gurus of all religions. They say that you don't have to do anything. You just need to depend on me. Accept me. Do what I say. Then your liberation is guaranteed. But the true teacher says you have to act. You have to choose. There are things which ought to be done, things which ought not to be done. And man alone has the power to consciously, self-consciously choose and act. Animals don't have moral power. Animals don't have moral awareness because they are not self-conscious. They are conscious but not self-conscious. So man being what he is, he has great responsibility to choose and act. Somewhere in the notes on the Bhagavad Gita, the teacher says, man alone has the power to retard his progress, his journey to the center of the spiritual sun. Whole nature is not meaningless, it's not a meaningless composition of atoms, but there is a grand purpose, meaning and object for this existence. And in that man plays a very significant role in the scheme of things. So man has to understand what is the purpose for which he is here, what is the purpose of existence, and then act in accordance with that object of life. He must become a co-worker with nature, aid nature's evolutionary impulse towards higher and higher development, higher and higher expression of the powers which are there within each one of us. There's a Persian poet who says that this life is like a few pages of written text that you have received. You don't know what was there in the preceding chapters because the pages are torn. You don't know what is there in the subsequent chapters. Those pages are also missing. You don't know the title of the book which you are reading. You don't know where the characters have come, why they are here, what has put them in this chapter that you are reading, what is the goal of this book that you are reading. And this is why there is so much confusion, meaninglessness, purposelessness that many, many modern day youngsters feel. And further he says, the solution to this is to know the previous chapters, know the subsequent chapters, and then your present life, which is one of the chapters that you are reading or experiencing, that becomes meaningful. Our present birth becomes meaningful, purposeful, only when we take it in the context of that which is eternal within us, and that which goes from birth to birth, garnering experience. That spirit within us must be understood. Those of us who love theosophy and who are so, attached to it, who study it and find it so important, do it because we find that theosophy gives us that clear map, which shows the meaning, purpose of existence, and demonstrates it through logical, scientific means. So the second A is of action, that is, we have to act, and it is through action that we reach the purpose, we reach the goal of our existence. In fact, the first A and the second A are two aspects of the same coin. Acceptance and actions are nothing but effect and cause. We act, and every event of our life is but a consequence of our actions. So you accept it and you learn through it. You discriminate, you do better, and then you act again to create a better future, to weave a better future and a brighter future for yourselves and everyone else. That's why Krishna says your Sharira Yatra cannot be accomplished without understanding, without action, right action. What that right action is, what is right action, wrong action? You need philosophy to know what is right and wrong, and then act along that basis. So that is about the second A. We'll quickly see what is the third A, altruism. All our suffering is finally rooted in one basic misconception. And that misconception is that I am separate from others. All our negative qualities, which leads us to commit sin, which entangles us in more and more suffering, which causes us to do wrong acts and make us bound by the reaction of those wrong actions, is all rooted in the wrong idea that I can attain happiness and peace at the cost of others. I can attain happiness and peace without being concerned about others. That's a mistaken notion. From that one mistaken notion arises all the other mistakes that we do over and over again and again, and then get caught in it. So altruism is absolutely important, because there is only the basic, the basic fundamental fact of life is there is only one self, there is only one spirit. Now, understanding that we are all one and acting from that basis, developing virtues, overcoming vices, and looking at our personal existence not merely from our birth to death, which is just one small chapter, but understanding the whole purpose of the book that we are reading, experiencing, which can only be done when we postulate there is something eternal in us, and that is our true self, the all self. This will help us understand what is spirituality.